Hi, everyone. My name is Natalie Gochner. This is Both Sides of the Aisle, and I represent the political center and have on the political left, Shireen Gourbani.
Hello, and hey, listeners. We're so glad you're sticking with us.
And on the political right, John Dougal.
Hey, good to be with you, and it's been a while.
Yeah, dog days of summer. So much is going on, and in Washington, D.C., they passed the big, beautiful bill.
Well, at least in the House.
Yeah, that's
right. Passed it in the House.
That's right. It's over in the Senate. I've done
so
a little bit.
So you're saying there's
a
chance.
Well, I've done a little bit of thinking about this. I don't think they pass it, you know, through both bodies till August. I think it's going to take that long. There is a reason why you get things done before the summer recess. You know, there's sort of a tradition in Washington that you get these things done before you go home, so you have a message for your constituents. I also think the debt ceiling hits in August, and so this bill raises the debt ceiling. So I think there'll be a lot of jockeying back and forth. But ultimately, Shireen, give us your quick take on this bill.
Oh, so this bill.
Yeah.
My take.
Big
your
bill.
Big, beautiful bill.
Is that this is a enactment of a number of things that we saw outlined in Project 2025 that fundamentally attacks working class and poor people in this country to the benefit of a tax cut for billionaires. And it does that while going after energy. I think really positive, productive, forward-looking policy on clean energy. It also does that while exploding the deficit. So that's what I think about this bill.
Yeah. Okay. John, I've got thoughts on it, but let's
so
go to you next.
You're not thinking it's great policy.
Yeah.
No, I don't.
Go ahead. You want me to
go first? Yeah.
Where do you start? My biggest frustration is all of the misinformation about the bill. If you just read the headlines.
On both sides.
Yep. If you just read the headlines, you come to one conclusion. And if you look at the New York Times, you read the Wall Street Journal, and then you go to the Kaiser Family Foundation and you start following sources and trying to get through it, you'll start to see that there's actually more to it. So let me give our listeners an example. They talk about, I think it's $800 billion in Medicaid cuts. And what I see is that they've largely kept Medicaid intact but raised work requirements. And by raising work requirements, you might get fewer, but you might not. And it exempts from those work requirements medically frail, people with substance abuse disorder, pregnant women, single mothers. And so they use on the Republican side that we're going after fraud, waste, and abuse. And they would say that if you're able-bodied, you should be working.
Yep.
And they also make the point that we shouldn't be providing it Medicaid to undocumented people in our country. And there's a pretty astounding number. The estimate I found was 1.4 million undocumented that are receiving Medicaid, not in Utah. We don't do that in Utah, but we do. We have shown a preference to provide children's health insurance to children, you know, and things like that. Mm-hmm. So I think it's more thoughtful than people give it credit.
Yeah. I mean, those that are saying Medicaid is being gutted, that's clearly not the case.
Like the big fear.
Those of me that wanted the 90-10 to go away.
Yeah.
And didn't really tackle that the way I thought it should have.
For our listeners. So we had all this, you know, hubbub about Medicaid expansion, which brought a lot of people off the rolls of the uninsured. That's the 90-10 population that John's referring to, 90% federal, 10%
state. Pays 10%, the federal government
and,
pays
and that remains in place.
That remains in place, even though for the traditional part of the program in Utah, it's 3-1, mm-hmm. so 75-25.
And the big fear was that would go away, but it didn't. What they did is try to crack down on the abuses within the system or places where it was arguably too generous.
Yeah. But it still didn't go far enough in terms of reforms from my perspective. But then you look at things in there. I like good tax policy that's going to, you know, get off people's backs and really help drive the economy. But then you see things that from a tax policy perspective to me, not taxing overtime or not taxing tips. It's like, okay, what is the rationale? Why is this type of income so preferred versus this other kind of income? That makes no sense to me.
Yeah.
And I'm one of those that I don't like the SALT deduction. Mm-hmm. So, you know, having it capped at 10K was great. And now they're raising it to, you know, upwards of 30, 40K. That to me is like, okay, we had a massive win in 2017. Why are we backsliding?
Yeah. So Shireen and I come from different sides of the aisle, and yet we're really dear friends. Shireen, I think if we got in a room and said to ourselves, what are the principles that we're going to go by? Like one of my principles would be, I don't want to add to the debt. I think you could do it. You just can't give big a tax cut. Yeah, I do.
I think the thing that's frustrating.
Maybe it takes you five years to get there. Our target should be not passing on our consumption to our children.
Sure.
So and so you build from there.
What's frustrating, I think, in listening to both of you is that I can understand wanting to kind of pick around the edges of whether or not we think able-bodied people should be on Medicaid. But what I fundamentally cannot tolerate is that we are talking about that while watching the biggest upward shift of wealth in this country's history. So the rich will benefit at the greatest rate from this kind, this big, beautiful bill, while people who are sick, who are struggling to get by, who cannot pay their bills in this country, who cannot feed their children, snap cuts.
Yeah.
That is what's on the table. And I just fundamentally have to say, like, that to me is just so wrong.
Yeah. And Shireen, it's just a matter of approach, right? Because I see the 21% corporate tax rate, the lower individual rates, the full business expensing through 2029, the 100% bonus depreciation. I see those as things that create opportunity in the economy and help lower income.
And
I don't see them.
Doesn't?
Well, go to work.
Okay.
You're able-bodied, get a job for 80 hours a month.
Sure, but I'll
I'm doing 70 a week.
let's just say that.
Is
well,
that all?
Maybe
come
it's
on,
65,
Allie,
but
yeah.
still.
That we have the most expensive healthcare system on earth with some of the worst outcomes, actually, considering how much we spend. And there would be a much better way to do that.
Yeah.
Could be socialized healthcare.
You won't get
the federal government out of it. Yeah.
Could be
yeah,
that, too,
you
but
won't
let's
get
just say.
Argument for me about the problems in our health system.
Yeah, yeah.
I get you.
Yeah.
Well, so the word I would say to our listeners.
The Senate is going to rework this thing.
Now they pick it
and
up.
Then,
yeah.
And then you'll have to see what is the dynamic between
so be
the
patient,
Senate and the House.
Read from both sides of the aisle. Reserve some judgment. Don't be quick to judge it. Try to look underneath the covers just a little bit here.
Sure.
That would be my
thought. Top line, this does explode. It actually continues to add to our deficit and includes massive upward trajectory of wealth.
Yeah.
It does.
Hey, on a funner topic, if we're adding to the deficit and whatnot, I'm reading about the U.S.
Funner,
Mint.
Adding to the deficit. Yeah.
Here we go. The U.S. Mint is going to phase out the production of pennies. I guess there's $114 billion worth of pennies floating out there.
Yeah. So I'm supportive of this, actually.
Good.
Sorry to all the coin collectors out
there. Why do you hate
there.
Abe Lincoln?
You know, it has to do with, I just find even like the way that I live, change just kind of collects in our house. We have, a little piggy bank that my kid has, and it's kind of fun, but we don't use it. And I can't imagine that it is fiscally responsible to keep printing these things year after year.
I saw something that said it takes 5 cents to produce a penny. It takes 14 cents to produce a nickel.
Yeah, that's interesting.
Yeah.
The price of a currency. Okay, we got just about 3.5 minutes or so. Let's do kind of a lightning round of a few things going on. I'm going to start with what's happening.
Yes
with,
or no answers.
With Doge.
No.
Musk has stepped back from the government efficiency thing, but they got a Freedom of Information Act request. The Justice Department argued that Doge is not a federal agency and therefore cannot be subject to a FOIA request. I'm like, then why do they get to do what they're doing?
Yeah. That's an excellent question. So why do they get to do what they're doing? But I think one of the things that I'm noticing, I don't know if others are feeling this too, but basically Elon Musk, I think, has learned that this is not good politics for him.
Yeah.
He's seeing massive hits to his own business. He is seeing, I think, his own companies in disarray.
Yeah.
And what we also know is that largely the public did not like this.
Yeah.
They didn't like an unelected, like the richest man on earth, maybe, buying his way into high level access. But what he got was the data that he wanted. And what he gets is the policy that he wants to continue the work that he's doing.
Yeah.
And I think that should be concerning to every American.
John, do you see Elon Musk eating a little humble pie here?
No, because he doesn't eat humble pie. But I do see that this is kind of a backlash and this is him, stepping back to a certain extent.
Yeah.
He wasn't able to accomplish what he wanted to accomplish. I think he learned that reforming government is much harder than it looks.
He also didn't save any money.
Yeah. Well, and maybe little tokens here and there. We'll have to see in the long term. But in the short term, clearly it didn't save any money and did not do the $2 trillion or the $1 trillion that was being advertised.
No, absolutely not.
John, then you had a U.S. federal judge who reversed Trump's closure of the U.S. Institute for Peace. Seemed like a solid legal argument there.
Well, this is one of those things where you get the judiciary and there's some things where I think they're absolutely correct. And sometimes I think they get too wound up.
Mm-hmm.
And I mean, I was, something where somebody was on the liberal end was all wound up about, the president must follow whatever the Supreme Court says.
Mm-hmm.
And that's not quite how I understand it, especially when it's something that's so long ago and you want to challenge it.
Mm-hmm.
Then you have to do something that forces it to get challenged.
I would just say it's evidence that in some cases our courts are still working.
Yeah, that's well said, Shireen. Shireen, you, I often hear you when we talk about President Trump's policies, you use the word grift.
Yeah.
So we had protesters gathering outside a dinner where the Trump coin investors were gathering. This was in at a Virginia golf club.
This wasn't pennies or nickels, was it?
Nope. They spent close to $400 million to gain access to the president, and many of them were foreign nationals.
Yes. So this is a way that, again, the grift continues, right? So the way that the Trump family is personally grifting off of his presidency is right now, a lot of it is happening through through these alternate forms of financial gain, mm-hmm. I guess I would say. Mm-hmm. Massive dollars coming back into the family based on the meme coin that he's developing. And we have very little policy guiding this. And he is making millions and millions of dollars.
Well, and this is where we've had issues with different political families over the decades of, you know, they benefit from their parents' connection in government, you know, mm-hmm. dad was a president, whatever it might be. And
Get on the speaker circuit,
get on circuit $100,000
boards,
whatever
speech.
It might be, you're getting paid.
$100,000 a speech is not quite the same as spending $400 million to gain access.
No, but
to
I'm just
Trump.
Saying this grift kind of concept, Americans have had concerns about this for decades.
I got it. Let's take a short break, but when we come back, I do want to talk about the federal funds for religious schools.
Okay.
So let's take a short break. Natalie Gochner with Shireen Gourbani and John Dougal. Stay tuned.
You're listening to Both Sides of the Aisle on Utah Public Radio. We love to hear from listeners like you. If you would like to send us a comment, email bsotapodcast@gmail.com. That's bsotapodcast@gmail.com. Thanks for listening. Shireen Gourbani on the left.
John Dougal on the right.
Natalie Gochner in the political center, and this is Both Sides of the Aisle. All right, you two. Federal funds for religious schools. This is the Supreme Court narrowly rejecting Oklahoma's bid to use federal funds to pay for what would have been the first religious charter school in the state. It was interesting to me that Justice Amy Coney Barrett recused herself. She's starting to really impress me.
Oh, interesting. So she did not give reason. Yeah. There are no requirements.
She was a big Notre Dame, you know, professor and Catholic.
And my understanding is she has a relationship or had a relationship with one of the founders of this school. Not like, you know, just interpersonally.
Business kind of. Yeah.
So I think, so what happened here was a 4-4 decision and she stepped out. So no decision. The lower court decision stays.
Yeah. And the opinion is one sentence. Mm-hmm. So it's basically, we can't read into it to see exactly what it's talking about or anything like that. It was an unsigned opinion. So,
yeah.
And I was looking forward to reading
would you,
that
would you thing. Have supported this though?
It depends. And here's the issue. And I've dealt with charter schools over the years. People look at it, charter schools as one way. And ironically, charter schools may be private schools run under a government contract, mm-hmm. or they may be government schools. It all depends how they're structured, how they're formed. Historically, most
but in
of
our
you,
state,
historically
they're all
in
government,
our state,
yeah?
Well, they're all government today. Mm-hmm. They used to be mostly private.
Yeah.
And I battled a state auditor against the State Board of Ed. They wanted certain uniform reporting and thought, well, we just make them all government and then we'll get the same reports as a result of this and this will somehow be good. I disagreed. I lost that debate. They're now all governmental. And so I can see if they're governmental and we're rolling into this religious thing, well, that's a concern.
Yeah.
If they're private under government contract, then I think we should allow allowance where parents can choose. If we're going to have vouchers or tax credits or whatever, mm-hmm. where parents can have choice in where they send their school, then we shouldn't get wound up about a religious school.
I come from a state with a large religious minority. Now, you have to think about what I just said there. But I think it was in 2007 when Utah stopped being a LDS majority state. So the LDS is population's large, but it's not a majority. But as someone who's from a state that has a large dominant religion, I'm all about protecting the minority and not forcing people to pay taxes that go to someone else's religious education.
Yeah.
So I would have voted to not allow these public monies in these charter schools.
Yeah.
Okay. Well,
and a big part of this money historically, and when you look across the nation, is the money can go to the non-religious portion of the education.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah.
And we can see, you know, over the years, it was, okay, this religious school didn't qualify for, playground equipment or, paving of a playground or whatever it might be. And the Supreme Court's come along and said, no, you can't discriminate. If you're going to have this kind of program, you need to treat all equally.
Right. Shereen, what did you make of the Trump administration precluding Harvard from enrolling international students?
Okay, so I just have to say I've been following some of the reporting on this, and one of the things that I think we sort of think about this in the abstract, like new international students potentially coming or not coming, and but this is creating a ton of uncertainty for international students who are already on this campus, who are enrolled in school, if they're going to be able to continue or not continue. The kinds of programs that bring them in are diverse. It's hard to kind of understand like where all these students are coming from, the backgrounds they're coming from. But I think that this, the thing that is like kind of a, like at the gut level, I never want to be as a state school graduate all the way through. It's hard for me to be on the side of Harvard, but I appreciate that Harvard is standing up.
Yeah, they are.
They really are. And they're doing it over and over again. And I think that this is where when people want to tell me, oh, there are things about the Trump administration they like, I have to fundamentally say, so then what you're saying is you're okay with this kind of political direct retribution on an institution over and over and over again. This is a very high level, very clear example of his personal grievances. And I guess in this case, around DEI.
Yeah, anti-Semitism.
Anti-Semitism.
What they're saying, but
Israeli students are being blocked.
Yeah,
from coming.
That's the irony.
Okay.
So.
Yeah,
this
really
is
crazy.
Nuts.
I have taught one class at Harvard, and it just speaks to this to me. Arthur Brooks teaches a class, and he had me guest lecture to it, and they were largely students from Mexico City. And boy, was it fascinating to see them learning about our system, you know, learning from our best and brightest, meaning Arthur Brooks, taking what they learn here and applying it in Mexico City. And the best thing we can do for our country and for the world is have a healthy Mexico. You know, I mean, it would be a beautiful thing, right?
Yeah.
It would solve our border problems. It would solve a lot of our drug problems.
Yeah.
We need these successful neighbors. I can't understand why you want to get in the way of learning.
Well, the interesting thing, I heard that 27% of Harvard students are international students. So this is a massive number of their student population.
But let's be clear, they could fill that in a minute's notice, right? Because they have so many more that apply than come. But what they're doing is it's merit-based, and they're bringing in people that make, you know, I'll call them, you know, national students better because you're around the best from all around the world.
Well, and this is a revenue generator, not just for Harvard,
students,
but for lots of schools. They generate money because those students, oftentimes, for example,
more.
In Utah, pay three times what the in-state
sure.
student is.
Yeah. Let's jump local. And Shereen, I know you can set this up. Governor Cox, he's been pretty clear he wants President Trump to disagree better. And he did a panel, I guess, at the Reagan Library.
Yeah.
You watched it.
Well, I listened to it.
Okay.
I listened to it because one of our listeners, I believe, sent it on to our producer who sent it out to us. And while I was going through just some kind of paperwork that I needed to complete, I gave it a listen. And I'll say it was interesting because it was the governor of New Mexico and our governor. And it is, there were many things that I found interesting and agreed with, right? The sense that so much in our culture right now really reinforces outrage, right?
Yeah.
So we want people to take positions of opposition. We want people to have hot takes. We want, you know, and that is what you get traction for. While that is true, right, I think what's difficult is this kind of underlying sense, and they talked about it quite a bit in the panel, is that if we actually spend time talking to each other, and the governor of New Mexico talked about the time that she spent, I believe, in Congress.
She's a Democrat.
Yes.
She's an R&D. Yeah.
And the work that she did to really join every club, to be with her colleagues as much as she could across political lines. I actually think it's one of the things that's most valuable about this experience for me, sitting here and speaking with you both, or at least, you know, another Republican.
Being patient with me.
Every week. Well, but it really does teach me to have a calm nervous system and engage in these conversations in ways that are beyond the outrage, right? That I even feel when I read the news. Now, I will say the thing that was frustrating for me was when they were both asked to speak to bipartisan wins, you know, things that they'd experienced that were successes. And to hear our governor talk to, you know, some legislation that really was collaboratively passed to provide protections to LGBTQ folks in our state. And that moment, and to the moment we are now, feel it's almost disingenuous to talk about that as a success in the ways that the queer community has been attacked in our state recently. So that was a frustrating element of it for me, because what I wanted to say is, okay, yes, like, yeah, these moments of bipartisan accomplishment are good and they should be celebrated and recognized. But what I also think is, like, underlying all of this is if we could somehow figure out how we see each other as human beings worthy of dignity and respect and the ability to thrive in a healthy way in our communities, we might just make a lot of different decisions.
Yeah. I'm happy to make a prediction here that I think our governor, Governor Cox, has national value and will make a contribution nationally at some point. He's a very young guy to be finishing as his elected service. And I don't know whether it's a cabinet appointment or whether it's, you know, something with an embassy. I just think he's got a lot of ability. And even if I look at his quote, John and Shireen, on this panel where he, speaking of President Trump, he said, he wasn't my first choice. He was far down the list. He knows this. We've had these conversations. Yet, you know, there was a moment where I could just burn it all down and say, that's what's going to happen. Or I can try to help and try to make things better. And that's certainly what I've attempted to do. So I think Shireen might take issue with how he's done it, but he's trying. And he's making, he's getting things for our state, helping our state, but still on edge with the president just enough.
One of the interesting things, you know, we've spent decades getting to the place that we're in. And I look and I see on both sides of the aisle this vitriol and viciousness when it comes to political topics.
Yeah.
And I don't even want to call it debate. And I wonder, what is it going to take for us to dig ourselves out of that hole? Because it's easier to go further and further and further. You know, mm-hmm. you think about, you know, this isn't quite that example, but you think about war. Once you get into war, you know, the animosity that you build up, and it's really hard to roll
Same
that
thing
back
with divorce.
And come to peace.
Yeah.
And so what I see is, if you will, political words in terms of kind of warfare language.
Yeah.
You know, when you turn on the TV, listen to the news, whatever it might be, this vitriol.
Yeah.
And I hope that we can somehow figure out how to back out of that.
Yeah.
But it's going to be really hard.
I'll just say Trump, like as an example, is to me pulling us in a direction that to me Republicans should be, and many are, so I don't want to discount this, should be screaming from the rooftops. You would be out of your minds if a Democrat was doing this, right? And to see folks, especially, I mean, Marco Rubio is an excellent example, just going along with things that are clearly unconstitutional and fundamentally at odds with who he was a year ago. That's concerning to me. Mm-hmm. And when Cox does say the right things, but then endorses him, basically steps out and continues, signed on to mm-hmm. letters supporting what feel like just so far afield from what Republicans held dear. Mm-hmm. I'm very frustrated.
Yeah.
I cut you off, Natalie.
No, you didn't. I empathize with what you're saying. I think I've worked in political offices enough to know that sometimes it's really hard because you're trying to navigate a course and at the same time stay relevant and stay in the game.
Yeah.
So who knows? Hey, Shireen, I want to ask you about this, and we'll be careful with you, John, here, since you work in the Attorney General's office. But AG Derrick Brown has spoken publicly about the fentanyl in this state. There was a 5-state raid that had 3 million fentanyl pills confiscated. Yeah. They made an arrest in Layton that seized $800,000 in currency.
Yeah. So I just have to say,
darn.
Back to, you know, you were mentioning these students from Mexico City and talking about, you know, if we had good, strong partners at the border, that we, some of our issues around drugs would be resolved. We have so many issues in our own country, and demand is certainly a big part of that. So when we think about the amount of folks whose lives have been touched by this, I just really want people to know that you are not alone.
Mm-hmm.
When we think about this level of a very, very dangerous, a murderous drug coming mm-hmm. across our borders, coming into our state. I know that people listening here have been touched by this, and I just want to acknowledge that I think it's good work that we're doing this, but there is an underlying problem here that
yeah,
we have to get
no
figured
doubt.
Out.
You're free to comment, John. If not, I got another topic. I'll ask you about this. We're seeing news that our Canadian tourist numbers, our visitor numbers, are really down. They're our largest source of visitors. It's directly because of the tensions between our country and Canada. I guess it's 40% of our international visitors.
Wow.
So think through that.
Wow.
The next highest is France and then Germany. But I mean, this seems like an unforced error. Like, why are we doing this to our country?
Are we doing this?
Yeah. Well, and I would say, you know, it's not really an unforced error on the part of Utah, but clearly the fight picked with the Canadians unnecessarily. You know, yes, there's some trade issues we got to work through with them, but they're one of our closest partners, and also unnecessarily, from my perspective, pick a trade war with them, which backfires in this kind of way. It's like so unnecessary.
Yeah.
Let's go deal with the small issues that we have.
Oh, goodness. I mean, does it mean we're going to get into our parks faster? Well, I guess since we cut a bunch of staff, probably
had some
not.
Coworkers say that. They're like, well, we'll get into our parks.
Yeah, I guess so maybe.
Good. Hey, any good news you want to share? We've talked about a lot of hard news. Any good news you two want to share with our listeners?
Oh, my goodness. I don't know.
The weather's amazing.
The weather's amazing. There's rain in the forecast.
Grandeur Peak this weekend and saw so many people on the trail. And I just kept thinking, we're mountain people. We are mountain people, and I love it.
Yeah. I would just add that it feels like such a wonderful time to engage. If you don't know your neighbors and they've got something beautiful happening in the yard, take a moment to congratulate them and meet your neighbors and talk about the rose bush they've got going or the vegetable garden they have. I think anything that we can do to build community in this time is good.
And I'm going to look and say 5 years ago, we had COVID, lockdown, all sorts of things like that. It's a whole different world today.
So see the beauty in every day, everyone. All right, that's a wrap. Natalie Gochner with the Political Center. I'm with Shireen Gourbani and John Dougal. The program's produced by Anthony Scoma. Thanks, everybody, for listening.